Dodgers and Diamondbacks at 10:08. The NHL, the Blackhawks play in Toronto. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday the 9th. Sunny for the morning hours, partly sunny and warm for the afternoon. High today, 76. 53 degrees tonight, 60% chance of rain, and a high of 62 tomorrow. Right now, sunny and 52 degrees for WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. Certainly one of the most significant figures on the world political stage is Vladimir Putin. And he is, of course, also a figure of some infamy, particularly for the long, troubling legacy of violence and political murder that is in his wake. A book has been written about this that is essential reading for anyone who wants to understand the particular sort of terror which Vladimir Putin and his inner circle have helped to create. The book is called Orders to Kill, The Putin Regime and Political Murder, published by St. Martin's Press. Amy Knight has already written extensively on this particular topic. Her previous books include Spies Without Cloaks, The KGB's Successors, The KGB Police and Politics in the Soviet Union, and also Who Killed Kirov, the Kremlin's Greatest Mystery. Again, this latest book, something of an overview of this sprawling topic called Orders to Kill. Amy Knight, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Could you say a word first about how you first became so interested in this really troubling and complex story?
Well, I've been studying Russia for a long time, at the Soviet Union, I should say, since the 60s when I went to the then Soviet Union as a student. And when I was actually there in 1967, I was arrested for consorting with dissidents, and I spent a night being interrogated by the KGB. I was released the next day, but since that time, I've always been very curious about the Russian security services. So I went on and got my PhD, and I taught, and I worked at the Library of Congress as a Soviet affairs, Russian affairs analyst. But my interest has pretty much centered on the security organs and the way the security and law enforcement organs have worked. in the Soviet Union and then in Russia. So Mr. Putin, as you know, is a former FSB officer. He headed the FSB, I should say, as a successor organization to the KGB. And he was the head of the FSB when he was catapulted into the leadership in the Russian government in 1999. He became prime minister, and then, as we know, he was elected president in 2000. But he's carried that past with him. And I've just been following Mr. Putin and looking at these strange coincidences of these murders of his critics and Kremlin critics, journalists and politicians. And so I really connect a lot of dots, is what I do in my book. And I think I offer a pretty convincing case that Vladimir Putin and his colleagues in the Kremlin have been behind these murders.
At one point, you call this, meaning Putin's regime, a truly criminal regime. Ahead of us talking about the specific focus of your book, I wonder if you could just sketch for us what prompts you to characterize the Putin regime in that respect, beyond the scope of this book, which of course focuses on these politically motivated murders of those who would resist him. In what other respects would we think of the Putin regime as a truly criminal regime?
Well, we can look at the so-called democracy in Russia, which really doesn't exist if you're talking about the political process. The Russian government controls all the television stations, and this is where the majority of Russians still get their news. They're fed a constant stream of pro-Putin nationalistic propaganda. They, when they go to the polls, they're usually offered only one candidate, which is from the pro-Putin United Russia Party. So they don't have, Russian citizens don't really have a say in their government. But there's more. I mean, we now know, and this is a well-established fact, that the entire Kremlin elite is just rampant with corruption. So these high-level officials have robbed the Russian people blind, and the corruption is, I mean, it's really very obvious to most people. And so, but yet Russians can't do anything about it. And then we look at their law enforcement. They have a criminal code. They have judges. They have courts. But really, the important cases are always settled by what we call telephone justice, which means bribing of judges or just simply ordering them what their verdict should be. So Russians, the Kremlin controls the judicial system and the legal system, the media, and the electoral process. So basically, they've deprived Russia of Russian people of any real democratic freedoms. And I think that makes them what I would call a criminal government.
One thing you say in the book that is intriguing, and I've read the book, so I certainly understand why you say this, but it's kind of interesting that these two things can be simultaneously true or both true. You certainly say more than once that Putin, Vladimir Putin, is very securely ensconced in power. I mean, he enjoys a very powerful grip on power in Russia. And yet, somewhere else in the book, you say the Russian president's hold on power has always been more illusory than real. Explain how that is true, and in a sense, how both of those things can both be true.
You know, that's a very good question. And when I say that President Putin's hold on power is illusory in a certain sense. What I mean is that these popularity ratings that he has, the high ratings in the polls, which hover around 85-86%, and I'm not alone in saying this, other political independent observers in Russia say the same thing, this doesn't necessarily reflect a deep veneration for Mr. Putin. So when Russians are asked in polls, you know, how they would rate him, they often say what they think they should say, first of all. And secondly, they, you know, this is their leader, and Russians are taught to venerate their leader. So they, you know, kind of go ahead and say, yes, they like Mr. Putin. But we're now seeing a kind of a disconnect in the sense that the Russian economy has been in decline for several years, and people's standards of living have declined. They are beginning, the ordinary Russians are beginning to wonder why it is that they're living so poorly and the elite is still living so well. So I think that there is, underneath these high ratings for Mr. Putin, there is a simmering discontent which could erupt into something, to a serious challenge to the Russian regime.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Amy Knight, talking about her most recent book, which is called Orders to Kill, The Putin Regime and Political Murder. One of the things you say about these widespread charges that Vladimir Putin and his closest followers have been behind a whole host of politically motivated murders is that there is no absolutely crystal clear direct evidence of President Putin himself ordering any of these things to occur, although the circumstantial evidence is pretty overwhelming. But you say that there are some who believe that President Putin is wise enough to never order such things himself directly, that he would never risk that kind of damage to his own reputation. But you suggest that that may in fact not be true, and that in fact there may be reason enough for him to act boldly in these ways, even if it would mean the risk of reputation of this somehow coming to light. Does that go back to what you were just saying, the fact that there is the potential for great unrest in Russia and that the stakes are higher? Or are there other reasons why President Putin would be so rash as to order these murders himself?
Well, again, that's a very good question. And what I really mean by what I wrote about that is that, of course, there would never be a smoking gun connecting any of these murders to Mr. Putin. Whoever has carried out these crimes on his behalf, they would be acting on what I would say is a wink and a nod from Putin. But in a funny way, so he has absolute deniability. But in an interesting way, I think that the Kremlin sometimes kind of wants to send that message that yes, these murders came from them, because it's a way of really intimidating the democratic opposition in Russia and Mr. Putin's critics. Now, I should say that in my book, the one case where we have really, I would say, concrete evidence tying the Kremlin to a political murder is the Litvinenko case in London. He was Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned by polonium in November 2006, and he was a defector from the FSB who had moved to the UK in 2000, and he had been very, very critical of Mr. Putin and his government. Now, there was finally, after several years and a lot of lobbying on the part of Litvinenko's widow, Marina Litvinenko, to whom I dedicate my book, by the way, the British High Court actually finally had extensive hearings into the Litvinenko case. And they concluded that, in fact, the murderers were these two men who were hired by the FSB, Alexander Lugovoy and Dmitry Kovtun. And the High Court concluded definitively that they were the ones who carried out the murder. Now, it was interesting that the judge, Sir Robert Owen, said probably that Mr. Putin and the then head of the FSB, Nikolai Patrushev, were the ones who ordered it. But he wasn't willing to go quite that far, again, because, you know, there's not a smoking gun. But most people were led immediately to the conclusion that, in fact, that crime was ordered by Putin. Hmm.
One thing you say about this period of numerous murders that represented the carrying out of the wishes of Putin himself, that this comes from a period in Russia that is even more frightening, even more unpredictable than the post-Stalin years. In what way is this a different situation than those tumultuous years? In what way are events even more unpredictable and even more frightening in Putin's Russia than they were back then?
Well, I certainly don't mean to say that life for Russians or for Soviet citizens during the Soviet period was better than it is now, because, of course, now people who live in Russia have the freedom to travel and to engage in private enterprise and to express their views. But what I'm saying is that in the Soviet period, under the Khrushchev-Brezhnev leadership, there wasn't this kind of secret violence that was carried out against citizens to keep them quiet, mainly because the regime had such a hold on its citizenship that it didn't really need to secretly murder people.
In other words, it could be done, in a sense, more openly.
Well, yes.
Without fear of reprisal.
And there was no pretense that they were anything but a totalitarian government. But if you knew the rules, you weren't going to get, you know, you weren't going to get shot or poisoned. So when I talk about the unpredictability under Mr. Putin, what I mean is that one just doesn't know what's going to happen to his critics from one day to the next. And, you know, I was asked yesterday what I thought about Alexei Navalny, who is this very popular Russian anti-corruption campaigner. He's now trying to compete for the presidency with Putin. And he's in jail right now for 20 days. And someone was saying, well, do you think he's going to – would the Russian government actually try to kill him instead of just, you know, putting him in jail once in a while? And, you know, I thought about it. It would be a really stupid thing to do, but one never knows whether someone in Mr. Putin's entourage might decide they wanted to do Putin a favor and get rid of Navalny, who, by the way, is probably one of the fiercest critics of Putin in the past 10 years.
Hmm. One of the most fascinating aspects of your book, and I certainly appreciate and applaud your diligence in trying to untangle a very complicated picture, is the portrait you paint of Putin's Russia as this police state, you say, run by police and security officials who are above the law and report only to Putin, who, of course, himself, as you say, is a former Soviet police officer. We read about all of these different agencies and these different people who have head them, and it ends up being a very tangled picture of and in certain cases we're talking about sorts of about battles over turf and who should do what, and who has jurisdiction over what. It's certainly a murky picture, and I suppose that in and of itself also makes it then all the more difficult to sort of track down the truth when it comes to some of these disturbing incidents.
Yes, that's very true. And you know, for years I was what was called a Kremlinologist, which was somebody who read between the lines to figure out what was going on at the top in the Kremlin. And you know, one needs Kremlinology today, because Putin and his colleagues keep things pretty well hidden. We really don't know how their decisions are made. Now, I did describe how the entourage of Mr. Putin, the top elite in the Kremlin, are so-called siloviki, and these are power men who have a history of coming from the police or the security agencies. And there are several different agencies in addition to the FSB that take part in what you might call euphemistically law enforcement. It is true that they are not always of one mind, and there has been considerable evidence that there's conflict sometimes, and that they compete. And every once in a while, one of these men will suddenly retire. But for the most part, this is a very close-knit group of people who need to stick together because they have to protect themselves. And if they let Mr. Putin fall, for example, they'd go with him.
You begin your book with what you regard as an especially chilling incident in February of 2015, something which you say took President Putin's sort of move of vengeance against his critics to an entirely different level. Explain the murder that we are talking about and the way in which it, in a sense, elevated all of this to a new, sickening level.
Well, you're right. It did elevate. It did elevate things to a new level, because if you look at Litvinenko, who was murdered in London, the Russians had labeled him a traitor. He had defected, and I'm not saying that was justified to kill him, but killing Boris Nemtsov, who had been a member of the Yeltsin administration. He was a deputy minister, and he knew Mr. Putin. And then he became an opposition politician. But he wasn't, he was a very popular politician, and he certainly hadn't done anything illegal. I think that Mr. Putin just viewed him as such a threat because he was becoming so critical of Putin. And like Navalny, he was publishing things that pointed to corruption among Putin and his supporters. But it was pretty shocking that the Kremlin would take it so far, because Nemtsov himself, although he acknowledged that he was possibly in danger, he told several of his associates who were journalists that he didn't think, because of his past being a member of the Soviet government and such a high-level politician, he didn't think that Putin would actually go so far as to have him murdered. So it was a very audacious murder. And, you know, they've never found out who ordered it. They rounded up some Chechens, and there was a trial. But as is often the case in these crimes, they don't find what we call the zakazchik in Russian, the person who ordered it. And it's that's the way it is in the Nemtsov case. And we probably won't find out until Mr. Putin steps down, if he ever does.
One of the threads of your book is, of course, the tremendous courage demonstrated by some of these, shall we call them, dissidents. And I wish we had time to to explore the stories of each and every one of them that, that are chronicled in your book. But I do want to take a moment to have you speak about a woman whose name I'm afraid I did not know until I read your book. And this is a name that many of us need to know, Galina Starovoitova. Explain who she was and what she did and said that led her to become, unfortunately, very likely, Vladimir Putin's first victim of murder.
Well, Starovoitova was a politician during the Yeltsin years, and she actually was a member of the Duma, the Russian parliament. And she had been very outspoken about the fact that she wanted the reforms that Yeltsin was introducing to go much further than they had. And among the reforms was she tried to pass a law, a lustration law, that said people who had served in the security services and were members of the Communist Party would not be allowed to then serve in the government. Well, you can imagine how how the FSB felt about this, and the members of the Communist Party. That wasn't the only thing that Starovoitova did. She also was very emphatic in talking about the corruption that was already becoming rampant in Russia, particularly in St. Petersburg. So she had a lot of enemies, and I think that there was concern that her voice was just going to become too loud, and that she was a very threatening person to people like the officials in the FSB who didn't want her to push for these democratic reforms. So, you know, she was gunned down in the stairwell of her apartment. It shocked everybody. But again, they've never found who did it. And I think in some ways it had an effect, because it silenced some voices of opposition.
One of the other threads of your book, which also I wish we had longer to talk about, is Western silence. Or maybe silence is too strong a word, but certainly the response of the West, of the White House and of other European leaders to these sorts of incidents has been rather tepid in your estimation when one thinks about the scope and the horror of what has been carried out in Putin's Russia.
Yes, and as I say in my book, Orders to Kill, I think that the problem is that Russia is a huge player on the global stage. They've got a huge nuclear arsenal. They are involved in Syria. We have the Ukraine problem. And so there's a strong sort of incentive on the part of Western governments, including our own, to quote-unquote do business with Russia. So for those considerations, I feel that, and this is particularly true of Mr. Trump, who, as you know, has had nothing but praise for Vladimir Putin, I think that it's better to avoid this very strong evidence that Mr. Putin does engage in having his critics murdered. It's something that I think Western governments don't feel they can do anything about. So, you know, why bring it up? But I should say that, in fact, they can do things, and one of them is keeping up those economic sanctions against high-level members of the Putin government. So they can do things. But I think it's largely these kind of overriding concerns. You know, we've got to do business with Mr. Putin, so let's just ignore some of the more unsavory aspects of his regime.
One of the last sentences in your book is this: hopefully the courageous efforts of the men and women I describe here, who died for the highest purposes of political life, have contributed to a democratic future for Russia and a better world. We can only hope. In the meantime, we can read your book and learn much more about all of this. The book, again titled Orders to Kill, The Putin Regime and Political Murder, published by Thomas Dunn Books, a division of St. Martin's Press, the author, Amy Knight. Amy Knight, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was a privilege to speak with you about your fine book.
Thank you for having me.
And we're approaching 8:40. Here is part two of today's Morning Show on WGTD. All of us are surrounded, it seems, all the time, I mean, nearly 24 hours a day, by photography. It is a technology which is now riding around in our pockets, within the heart of our phones, all around us. It's one of the easiest things to utterly take for granted, which is just one of the reasons why I really encourage you to seek out an absolutely gorgeous and also massive book called Photography, The Definitive Visual History, in which we are shown the long and fascinating history of photography, of how it has developed and how various technological breakthroughs have changed the nature of photography, who has had access to it, and the way in which it has helped shape our world and shape our understanding of the world. The author of the book is Tom Ang. He has done a great deal of writing, created a number of different books in both digital and print media, and has been active in the field of photography for a long time, was for a time senior lecturer in photographic practice at the University of Westminster, London. And his wide-ranging expertise in photography serves him well in putting together this beautiful book published by DK. And I'm very pleased to be able to speak with Tom Ang about his book, again called Photography, The Definitive Visual History. Tom Ang, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be on.
I wish so much that this weren't radio. I wish this was television. I very seldom wish that as I do interviews, but in this case, I would give just about anything to be able to hold up this book and have those who are listening to us see it with their own eyes. It's a real work of art and also full of fascinating information. As someone who already knew, of course, a great deal about photography, nevertheless, did you understand the scope and complexity of the challenge before you in putting together this kind of definitive history of photography?
I've been studying and reading photography for 30 plus years. I think what really I found tricky, and you can imagine why when I tell you, was the need to provide some kind of context. You know, if you read what I say about the Great Depression, I think I summarized it in like two sentences, three sentences for the Great War, five sentences for the Vietnam War. That was a tough bit, to say something meaningful, which gave some kind of context and location for the photography and for the photographers that took place there.
We should maybe mention that the book really does unfold chronologically. And one of the things that I most admire, besides just all the attention to detail here, is that you have come up with some very meaningful eras, a framework in terms of these decades being this for photography and these next decades representing something else. And they're not cleanly delineated 20 years here and 20 years there. But, I mean, you've clearly thought a lot about the history of photography and its various phases. And while some of them, like the dawn of photography, is pretty obvious, in many other cases, it seems to me you've really had to look long and hard in order to figure out what was most significant about photography in, for instance, the late 19th century.
Yes. I mean, thank you. Yes, I did look long and hard, and I also worked hard not to repeat the kind of institutionalized answers that we had for the history of photography. For me, it was important, for example, to give equal footing to the technologies of photography as to great photographers, something which hardly any history of photography does. Because for me, if we didn't have the cameras, the films, or the lenses, we couldn't make the pictures that we make. And for me, it was also important to highlight some of the neglected figures and to also also actually incorporates some new research. For example, Roman Vishniak is celebrated for his photography of the Jews prior to their persecution in the Second World War. But some new research has actually thrown light on some of his motivations and some of his, let's put it, lapses in memory. And that kind of small detail which illuminate the lives of photographers and the lives of people around them, those were the little details which I was really looking for, which is not what I think classical art historians look for.
We're speaking with Tom Eng about his book, Photography, The Definitive Visual History. I want to ask you about one thing, but I wish we had time to talk in great detail about the beautiful introduction you've written to the book. Among many interesting things you say, you say at one point, compared to other arts developed over thousands of years, photography is still in its infancy. First of all, that was not exactly news to me, but I had never really stopped to ponder that. I wonder what the significance of that is, the fact that photography, although we think of it as having been around a long time, in fact is in its infancy.
I wish I knew the answer to that. When I was thinking about the history of photography, it struck me very early on that thousands, millions of years ago, we may have started to chant and sing to each other, and now here I am listening to a 3-hour-long Wagner opera, whose roots go all the way down back to these fireside chants, and it made me realize that actually, in terms of actual elapsed time, photography as an art, compared to say opera, is still at the fireside. We're still chanting. We're still figuring out what the hell we can do with this. Now, of course, our technologies and everything else are much more advanced. But in terms of how photography could develop, I think there's nothing but kind of exciting potential. And let me give you one example. In only 10 years, basically, we have gone from images being basically singular, in other words, they're on a print, only one person can see it at a time, to images being connected, to images which we can put onto the internet in one social media or another, and which could be seen by millions, potentially, at a time, and sometimes they are. Now, that's taken place in a very short space of time, and I tell you, I was writing future crystal ball reading articles 10, 15, 20 years ago, and I never got anywhere near the concept of the connected image. So, who knows what's just around the corner.
You write, clearly the best of photography is yet to come. I do have to say, for as much as your book enlightens us about some of these very recent developments. I mean, we all know, of course, about this dawn of digital photography. I mean, most of us use it all the time, but you also help us really understand its ramifications, and I so appreciate that. On the other hand, I'm very grateful for all that you tell us about the dawn of photography, about the way in which this technology first came into being. And while I was acquainted with the very first photograph taken back in 1826, an image you reproduce here, I didn't know about some of what had come just before it. For instance, this technology that involved something called the heliograph. In fact, you reproduce for us a heliograph from 1825, which in some ways could be called an even older photograph than the one I just mentioned. Just tell us a moment about this primitive technology that helped pave the way.
Well, the interesting thing about all the early inventions in photography were that they were pushed by guys who wanted to compensate for their lack of artistic ability. So the heliograph, for example, was Niepce thinking, well, look, I want to engrave, but actually I'm useless at engraving. So what can I do to get the sun, to get some technology to do the work for me? And that's when he conceived of the possibility of actually using the light and the dark to produce light and dark in a printing plate. Basically, it was a slab of rather sticky tar. But it was the same with Fox Talbot when he came back from holiday, and his wife and his children had produced some pretty drawings of Lake Como, and his were pretty pathetic, actually. And he thought, this is really pretty pathetic. What can I do to get nature to do the pencil work for me, which is why he called his first book Nature's Pencil. And it was the same with Daguerre. Daguerre was a set painter, and I think basically he got fed up of making paintings sets after sets for his theater. So he wanted a mechanical way of doing it. And that's what these guys were all motivated by.
One of the most spectacular moments in the book is the first time we see a large reproduction of a particular photograph, and then we see off to the side the way in which you highlight various aspects of that photograph,
mm-hmm.
and help us understand what makes it notable. In this case, it's a very famous old photograph of a boulevard in Paris in 1838, and it helps us understand just what makes this photograph so notable. Say a word about it.
Yeah, the Boulevard du Temple is, first I have to tell you the story about it. It's tragic, because the original daguerreotype was probably one of the early ones, which meant that actually it was a little bit scratchy. It wasn't polished to the quality that was introduced a couple of years later. So some helpful museum curator thought actually he'd clean it up. What he didn't realize, and he jolly well should have, is that a daguerreotype is basically just a thin layer of an amalgam of mercury on silver. It's extremely delicate. So, of course, when he tried to clean it, he totally destroyed it. But fortunately, the historian Beaumont Newhall had come across it and made a good film-based copy of it. And so that's what we have now. That's the only thing that's surviving. The big controversy about that, about the picture, which we talk about in the book, is that it actually shows two people. And so everyone says, well, this is the first time people were ever photographed. And the question is then, were they set up or not?
Mm. We should remind people that... We should remind people that we're talking about this Paris Boulevard, and then in the... towards the foreground of the picture is the small figure of a man who appears to be having his shoe shined. And that solitary figure is all we see, although presumably there are other people walking on the boulevard who do not appear because of the long exposure. But it's a striking photograph. Go ahead.
Indeed. This is where we want to be on TV, isn't it?
Right, exactly.
yes, the picture was taken in the morning. And the boulevard would have been full of people. But because there was a long exposure, probably in the region of 30 or to maybe even 60 seconds, everybody is blurred and disappears. But the two people who are relatively stationary, which is the guy having his shoe shined and a boy, do appear as shadows. But the big question is why he was shining his shoe right there. It's right on the corner of a boulevard where the pedestrian, you would say, sidewalk area is almost as wide as the boulevard itself. And yet the shoeshine and his client are positioned right on the street corner where it's perfectly positioned for the photograph. So, you know, even in an old historical picture like this, there are controversies and questions.
Mm. What is striking?
I'll just finish off by saying, but what that picture shows is that Daguerre was an artist, and he would have made a great photographer, I think, if it hadn't been for the fact that by giving away his invention to the French government gave him a nice annuity, and we hear nothing of him again, which is, I think, a real pity, because I think he would have been a really fine photographer.
Hmm. Your book goes on to describe various ways in which photographers came to sort of stretch the technology, develop new ones, and find new ways to utilize photography in things like capturing images of war. One of the most intriguing moments, actually, I want to just have you talk a moment about is a little chapter called Photographing Children. And, of course, back in the days when it took a long time to expose a given image in taking a photograph, it's one thing to have a stately gentleman stand still, but what about a child? You tell us there were some intriguing techniques by some photographers to keep children still and sedate.
There are handbooks of child photography from the time that give recipes for the amount of chloroform the strength of chloroform, which are suitable for keeping the child still or subdued, but not actually sending them off to heaven. And there were also contraptions to hold them still while being trapped them basically while being invisible to the camera.
Fascinating.
And in the book, there's some wonderful example. There's one wonderful example of the many that exist of a mother who has disguised herself under a drape in order to hold the child still. these pictures just look weird.
Absolutely.
To us, but to them, not at all.
The book is chock full of, I have no idea if it's hundreds or thousands, it certainly feels like thousands of notable photographs from all over the years, and in many cases you also take us behind the scenes of some of these photographs as they were gathered together. I want to finish by asking you about this new age of the digital photograph. And the fact that you say that photography has now become so commonplace and ubiquitous that it has lost its sense of the particular. So are we going to regain that? Or is this the way it's forever going to be when it comes to photography?
Yes, that was one of my philosophical moments that escaped the editor's razor, that one. I think we've lost a sense of the particular in a number of ways. I think, for one thing, there are probably around 3 billion photographers on the planet now. Okay, there are 3 billion camera phones. For another, us photographers around the world, we make about 1.5 trillion images a year. All right, I'll let that soak in. 1.5 trillion. So that's a lot of knots. That's a lot of pictures every second of the day. And in addition to that, we have pictures which are now basically, they are connected. We make one picture, and if we show it to our family on Facebook or friends, then potentially it's actually available to thousands, if not millions. So that's the sense in which I think we have lost the sense of the particular, that actually they are, photographs are now increasingly really, really thin slices of our existence. There was a time when because of film or the technologies or actually just the sheer cost of making a picture, we were very particular about the time slice that we chose. In which we made the picture, but now that we just slice through our lives any old how, because we can.
Well, this book gives us so much to think about and to enjoy. Again, it's titled Photography, the Definitive Visual History published by DK. Tom Eng, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your amazing book.
It's been a great pleasure. Great pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, believe it or not, we'll be spending a little bit of time talking about